Matter of State versus Delshawn Taylor. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Yes, we have Betty Spencer, who is signing all the papers of the ACBA.
Welcome, counsel.
Thank you, and may it please the court. I'd like to reserve just a few minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
It's fine.
Thank you. The question in this case is whether a prosecutor's denial of a Graves Act waiver is reviewed under patent and gross abuse of discretion or ordinary abuse of discretion. There are two things at the heart of this case: separation of powers and consistent principled jurisprudence. The constitutional principle of separation of powers is what is behind this court's distinction between the two standards of review. In PTI, this court has recognized that is fundamentally a prosecutorial decision, the decision to defer pursuit of the prosecution. And therefore, we give extremely deferential review to the prosecutor's decision to deny admission to PTI, because it is quintessentially prosecutorial function, calls for restrained judicial review. And under the patent and gross abuse of discretion standard, a prosecutor's decision to deny PTI will rarely be overturned. On the flip side, ordinary abuse of discretion has been found to be appropriate whenever the court reviews a decision to either deny a waiver of a mandatory sentencing provision or in Ligaris to move for a mandatory sentencing provision, because sentencing is quintessentially a judicial function. And therefore, judicial review is necessary even when the statute itself does not call for judicial review. So turning to principled consistent jurisprudence, there are five provisions where the legislature has authorized a prosecutor to exercise discretion over a mandatory sentencing provision. So there's the Graves Act, there's the mandatory minimums for drug offenders, there's the repeat drug offender mandatory extended term, Jessica Lunsford Act, and the forfeiture of public employment.
And the third one you mentioned, I'm sorry, I missed.
The Jessica Lunsford Act?
No, before that.
The mandatory extended term for repeat drug offenders under 43-6F.
Yeah, got it, thank you.
And for all four other than the Graves Act, this court has held that ordinary abuse of discretion is the standard of review. And for the same reason, because it is a sentencing provision, which is quintessentially a judicial function, we ask that the court apply the same standard for Graves Act waivers. Neither the state nor the attorney general has offered any principled basis to distinguish the Graves Act waiver statute from these other waiver statutes. And in fact, there's no principled basis to do so. The state and the AG claim stare decisis. They say that we have offered no special justification to depart from the patent and gross standard other than, quote, abstract notions of consistency with case law, and, quote, all we can say is that the standard of review is intellectually inconsistent with this court's rulings. We do say that, and we believe that if this court finds the patent and gross abuse of discretion standard is entitled to stare decisis, that those do provide a special justification to depart from that. And the choice between consistent principled jurisprudence or just sticking with something because it's been around a long time, this court has always chosen consistent principled jurisprudence, and we ask that the court do so here as well. So as I conclude my opening, I'd like to structure my argument as follows as I open myself up to the court's questions. I'd like to start with outlining the development of judicial review in PTI and the mandatory sentencing provisions, explain why the current standard of review for the Graves Act waiver statute is wrong and why it should be ordinary abuse of discretion, and then ask this court to remand to the presiding judge for reconsideration under the correct standard and give some guidance as to what abuse of discretion would look like in the context of the Graves Act. So that concludes my opening. So beginning with PTI, Leonardis II in 1977, the question before the court was, does the statute, the separation of powers, authorize judicial review of a denial of PTI? And the court said, well, PTI at that point, it was created by court rule. The Constitution authorized the court to have power over creating court rules, and that implies the ability to enforce court rules. And so there has to be some judicial review. However, the court recognized that the scope of review should be limited, mindful of the prosecutor's duty to enforce the law. Great deference should be accorded to the prosecutor's decision to deny PTI. Therefore, this court created for the first time the Patton and Gross abuse of discretion standard, that the courts may only override the denial of PTI where there's clear and convincing evidence showing a Patton and Gross abuse of discretion by the prosecutor. In Dalgish in 81, this court was reviewing a decision. Now, this was after the legislature had actually officially adopted PTI in 2C43-12. And after the adoption, the appellate division had found that actually now the ordinary abuse of discretion standard should apply. But this court reversed and said that the concerns over the separation of powers remains. Judicial review infringes on the legislative power to define crimes and the executive responsibility to enforce laws, so it must be performed with sensitivity. And this court stuck with the Patton and Gross abuse of discretion standard.
Is there any reference to any kind of judicial review in 6.2?
There is only reference to the assignment judge's role in deciding between the probation or the 1 year parole ineligibility period once the prosecutor decides to waive. There's no reference to any judicial review of the prosecutor's decision not to waive. And that's the same.
Or to consent, because the assignment judge also is only on consent of the prosecutor, right? So there's no reference to any judicial review over any of the prosecutorial decisions, correct?
That's correct. And that has been the same for all five of these in terms of the reviewing of the decision whether or not to waive. And this court first confronted this question in Ligaris, because the 43.6F says the court, a sentencing court, shall, upon motion of the prosecutor, impose the mandatory extended term for the repeat drug offenders, does not authorize judicial review. This court found that it would be unconstitutional. It would violate separation of powers if it were just left at that. And the court held that there had to be three safeguards to construe it constitutionally. One, there had to be uniform attorney general guidelines. Two, a statement of reasons for, in that case, moving for the extended term. And three, judicial review.
Would it be unconstitutional if the legislature said in any case of this particular crime, the sentence must be X?
No, the legislature has the authority to mandate a specific sentence. If the legislature chose to, for every single crime, not give a range, but just give a specific sentence, that would be, under our jurisprudence, under demerits, that would be authorized. But when the legislature does ultimately give a range and does leave it to the judge to impose the sentence, it is ultimately the judge's authority to determine what is the appropriate sentence.
But when they don't give a range, sorry, so you said it is okay for the legislature to mandate a particular punishment, but it's not okay for the legislature to say that the choice of a particular punishment goes to the prosecutor instead of a court.
It is okay so long as those three protections from Ligaris remain in place.
But that's only because it would be unconstitutional. It's not okay, meaning it's unconstitutional for the legislature to say this choice is up to the prosecutor and not the court.
Up to the prosecutor without judicial review would be unconstitutional. And in Ligaris, the court began again with separation of powers and said that although the branches aren't hermetically sealed, they're not watertight. And Ligaris acknowledged that legislatures do have authority over sentencing, as we were just discussing, and prosecutors have influence in terms of charging decision, that at the end of the day, sentencing is at its core a judicial function. And Ligaris cites Warren for that, also cites Leonardis. And Leonardis finds this principle on page 369, all the way back at the founding era, and also post-Reconstruction, citing cases as early as Clifford v. Heller in 1899. And it's just the first line of Article 6, where that the fact that sentencing is a core judicial function, investing the judicial power, that is understood. It's always been understood to include sentencing. Ligaris looks at Leonardis and quotes Leonardis's standard of review as Patton and Gross abuse of discretion. But ultimately, when Ligaris holds what standard of review is necessary for sentencing provisions. It holds that arbitrary and capricious review is what's necessary. Following Lagares, Vasquez applied arbitrary and capricious ordinary abuse of discretion to 3512, the waiver of mandatory minimums for drug offenses. This court first compared the standards in explicitly in FLAG, which was the forfeiture of public employment and the waiver of that. And this court held that the decision to waive forfeiture of public employment is dissimilar to the determinations typically made by prosecutors in their law enforcement capacity, like PTI, and more akin to prosecutorial discretion in sentencing relating determinations. So therefore, an abuse of discretion would be the more appropriate standard. This court reiterated that dichotomy in VA, noting that the ordinary abuse of discretion standard had been applied to prosecutors' authority over sentencing decisions. So why are we in a different place with respect to Graves Act? Well, it seems just to be a product of history. Alvarez was the first case to review this, the Appellate Division decision in 91, and it came before Lagares. So it didn't have the benefit of any of those cases. And Alvarez didn't choose either standard. Alvarez articulated an entirely different standard, that it's the assignment judge reviews for whether the prosecutor arbitrarily or unconstitutionally discriminated against the defendant. And that doesn't, fall within.
But Judge Stern and Alvarez viewed that as analogous to the PTI standard of review.
In Watson, Judge Stern, who also wrote Watson, went back and characterized Alvarez as patent and gross abuse of discretion. But in Alvarez, Judge Stern actually does distinguish from PTI and almost suggests that the Graves waiver should get less review than PTI. He wrote that he did not envision a Leonardis type hearing necessary in every instance where the prosecutor refuses to move for a Graves Act waiver. And we think that does not comport with how this court has interpreted these mandatory sentencing provisions from Lagares forward. So Alvarez predated Lagares.
So Alvarez itself, I'm sorry, I was confusing those two, is arbitrariness constituting an unconstitutional discrimination or yes. Denial of equal protection?
Yes.
Is more of a constitutional standard?
Yes. And
also say patent abuse of discretion, right?
Abuse, yes.
Alvarez, the one area where they say patent or gross abuse of discretion, is when the court was discussing the dissent in Senges, not when it's actually describing the standard. Although in Watson, which was also written by Judge Stern, he goes back and characterizes Alvarez as if it were a patent and gross abuse of discretion standard.
Prosecutor's refusal was a patent and gross abuse of discretion.
Yes. And then in Benjamin, that was not the question before this court. This court granted on the discovery issue. And in fact, at one point when the Attorney General asked the court to pick a standard, it was noted that that was not the question before the court and the parties had not briefed it. So I don't read Benjamin as affirmatively deciding this issue in terms of what the standard is. It's not until Rodriguez that Rodriguez is actually claiming, oh, it's been patent and gross abuse of discretion. It's the same as PTI this entire time. So we think there's a significant lack of clarity throughout the case law. And we don't think there's any basis to distinguish the Graves Act waiver statute from the other four mandatory sentencing provisions.
Which do you view as the closest analogy of the cases already decided? I mean, obviously, VA, ATC, the series of cases where it's already been decided. Which is the closest analogy in terms of what is the prosecutorial function here?
We believe that each of the four are an equally close analogy.
So any mandatory minimum, waiver of mandatory minimum would be essentially the same as this case?
Yes. And this court isn't distinguished in terms of the standard of review between the repeat drug offenders or the mandatory minimum for drug offenders.
Abuse of discretion.
Yes.
But it's an abuse of discretion that has to be proved by clear and convincing evidence, right?
That's what Lagares says, yes, and has been repeated. That's correct.
And it's an abuse of discretion that acknowledges that the decision is up to the prosecutor, so it can't just be whether the trial court disagrees.
That's correct. There is deference, but the big difference is the deference is different from the deference in PTI. The extreme deference of PTI is such that this court has said a prosecutor's decision to deny PTI rarely will be overturned. It has to be, in order for you to overturn a PTI denial, it has to rise to the level of it's gone so far wide of the mark sought to be accomplished by PTI that fundamental fairness and justice require judicial intervention. And that's a much higher standard than the ordinary abuse of discretion.
If Alvarez relied on Changiz to a degree, and then Vasquez sort of abrogates the Changiz, this PNG standard, is that where things sort of go awry from your perspective, or do they go awry with Watson mischaracterizing the standard that Alvarez relied upon, or both?
Probably both. I do think one of the issues is, unfortunately, and I'll just be honest, like I didn't necessarily, I argued Andrews, which is one of the more recent published appellate division cases, finding that there was an abuse of discretion and affirming the assignment judges overturning the denial and ordering.
You mean it's a Graves case?
Yes. And I argued that case under patent and gross abuse of discretion, because that was what I read the case law to say in terms of Watson. And I had that point, I was arguing for a particular client. I didn't think, all right, let me step back and look at all of the case law for all of these different provisions and see whether or not it's consistent. I just accepted it as what was said and made that argument on behalf of my client. I think that's what has gone on. We haven't had the opportunity to step back like we did in Flagger VA until this case, until the court granted review here. And in fact, in Watson, if we look at page 535, the court specifically notes that neither party suggested that Alvarez is out of date in light of Lagares and Vasquez, or suggested that attorney general guidelines are required. And that was in 2002. So, sometimes it's just the case that the party, the defense bar may not realize that this is an issue and bring these arguments until you have a certain case and can step back and look. And that's why we're grateful to be here and have the court take a close look at this. I would like to turn to looking at why the judge's application of the patent and gross abuse of discretion standard made a difference here.
Can I just pause you for a second? If you were teaching a law school class and you were asked, what's the difference in practice between those two standards, what would you say?
The simplest way is that the judge is almost never going to impose order PTI over the prosecutor's objection, whereas there is an avenue for the judge to giving deference to the prosecutor, but to order a waiver over the prosecutor's objection if the standard's met. I would say that's the, and then I can go into how it's applied, which I would like to address if that would answer your Honor's question. So in terms of how it would be applied, we actually agree largely with the Attorney General's characterization that because the way the guidelines work, so the guidelines are the center of all of this analysis, right? That's what is required in order to provide uniformity. And the Attorney General in 2008 issued these guidelines, and they should be the heart of the analysis. So were the guidelines referenced? Were they followed correctly? And the Attorney General suggests that the review of the analysis, the guidelines of an assignment judge reviewing the prosecutor's application should be similar to that of the appellate division reviewing a sentencing judge, because that's also abuse of discretion. And we find that analogy largely to be apt. And in particular, the reason it works here is the guidelines mostly center themselves on an analysis of the aggravating and mitigating factors. So the 2008 guidelines on page 13 say that the prosecuting agency, as part of the initial plea offer, shall agree to move for a reduction to the one-year term unless the prosecutor determines the aggravating factors outweigh the mitigating factors, or that the reduction would undermine the prosecution or investigation of another. So shall move for a waiver unless one of those two factors apply, or unless, of course, you're ineligible because you have a prior Graves offense, or aggravating factor 5, which is the organized crime aggravating factor, applies. So those are the four exceptions to this standardized plea offer. And in fact, in the 2014 clarification, the Attorney General does refer to this on page 8, as the 2008 directive established a rebuttable presumption that the prosecutor will agree to reduce the mandatory minimum to 12 months of parole ineligibility. So the most frequent reason for denial that will come up, of course, will be when the prosecutor decides the aggravating factors outweigh the mitigating factors. So that's why we do think it's an apt analogy to say the assignment judge should review the prosecutor's assessment of those factors and similar abuse of discretion deferential standard to how the appellate division reviews a sentencing judge. So you're not substituting your judgment. You're looking at their reasons. Was there competent, credible evidence in the record? Did they consider all appropriate factors? Did they consider any irrelevant or inappropriate factors? And in fact, Andrews gives an example of where the prosecutor did abuse their discretion. The state and Andrews failed to cite the directive at all, failed to analyze the aggravated mitigating factors, and looked at a factor that it previously considered to be mitigating and then failed to consider it mitigating here, which was the obtaining the firearm for a self-protective purpose. And then looking at this case in particular, we believe that the standard of review made all the difference to presiding judge Law. So when she first, at the first sentencing proceeding, reviewing the PSR, she believed that the 42-month parole disqualifier would be the wrong sentence for Mr. Taylor. She found the defendant had established a prima facie case and requested the state explain why Mr. Taylor was denied a waiver, and ultimately found that, and we're not relying exclusively on the comparator analysis, that does get a little tricky, but found that 5 of the 15 cases that the state that they had identified were on their face worse than Mr. Taylor, and found that contrary to the state's assertion, the mitigating factors outweigh the aggravating factors, and felt that waiving the sentence down to 1 year would be more appropriate. But reviewed, she felt she was bound by the standard in Rodriguez, that it was patent and gross abuse of discretion, that the court could not substitute its judgment. And ultimately, although she said her conscience told her that this sentence was wrong for Mr. Taylor, that she felt bound, and that she felt the prosecutor's abuse of discretion was not patent and gross. So it appears by her reasoning that it made the difference here, which is why we're requesting a remand to the presiding judge to reconsider this under what we believe is the correct standard in the first instance.
Even if abuse of discretion applied, she still couldn't substitute her judgment. It just would be a view under a different standard.
The court has also said that it's not a substitute of judgment. The difference there is when you're reviewing the prosecutor's assessment of the aggravated and mitigating factors, the assignment judge or presiding judge, as here, wouldn't look at Mr. Taylor in the first instance as if they were the sentencing judge and then sort of compare. They would first have to look at the prosecutor's statement of reasons and assess that. That's where the analysis would begin. And that's how you avoid substituting your judgment. So there are a number of areas where we think the judge could have rightly found the prosecutor did abuse their discretion here. For example, violating KS, relying on dismissed charges or charges that did not result in a conviction. That would be, consideration of inappropriate factors as just one example. And, even if we look back at the state's original letter denying the waiver, the 2020 letter, the state didn't even assess the aggravated mitigating factors. The state didn't identify the basis under the guidelines that they were denying the waiver. And in fact, when referencing the directive, the state said, well, there's nothing here that takes this case outside of the heartland. But that's the standard that the directive applies to probation, not to the waiver in general. The directive says, shall give a waiver unless one of these 4 exceptions apply. So even that is some evidence that there was an abuse of discretion here. Just a few other comments before I wrap up. Obviously, if the court has further questions, I'm happy to answer them. The reason that we believe remand for reconsideration of the appropriate standard would be the right decision as opposed to considering, I'm not asking this court to consider in the first instance whether there was an abuse of discretion. That's generally what this court has done. When the court clarifies a standard that was not applied below, this court is generally remanded for reconsideration of that standard. So in 2 cases recently in 2021, State v. DeSeer, that's 245 NJ 179, where this court clarified the standard for discovery at a Franks hearing, remanded for reconsideration in the first instance. CR VMT, that's 248 NJ 428, whether sexual activity was consensual under SASPA, this court remanded for reconsideration in the first instance. So that's why we believe that's the appropriate remedy here. And then just briefly, with respect to the Attorney General did raise the question of retroactivity. So if this court chose to reach that question, we do think that pipeline retroactivity would be appropriate. I don't have precise numbers in terms of the third prong, the effect of administration on just, the effect a retroactive application would have on the administration of justice. However, just anecdotally, I'm not aware, myself and one other colleague of mine, my colleague who argued Benjamin, Mr. Rockoff, are the two point people in my office, the appellate section, who field all questions from trial attorneys regarding Gray's Act waivers. And we're not aware of many cases that are currently on appeal that involve Graves Act waiver denials, certainly under 10. And then as far as administrability, it's certainly a much narrower remand to remand for reconsideration and resentencing than it is to remand for a new trial. So that's also a factor in favor of pipeline retroactivity. And with respect to degree of reliance, given sort of the ambiguity between these two standards, the arbitrary or discriminatory and the patent and gross abuse of discretion, we're not sure that there is such a large degree of reliance. And in none of those cases did I see any analysis citing Lagares, Vasquez, comparing that standard to the PTI standard. So I'm not sure that there's such a large degree of reliance. And I do think that for consistency, pipeline retroactivity would be appropriate.
Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
Rosenberg.
May it please the court. I will try to be brief. I would like to begin by sharing a kind of a personal but relevant coming a full circle. About a little shy of 50 years ago, as a 25-year-old public defender, I appeared as amicus in my first argument in any court, and was in this court, not this courtroom, in State versus Leonardis, soon to be called Leonardis I. And then 10 months later, at the ripe old age of 26, I argued Leonardis II. At that point, we had assumed direct representation of Mr. Leonardis. My adversary, as I recall, was the late, great Bob Del Tufo. And I was pleased to hear today Mr. Welfel refer to the Clifford case, which I looked at my brief, which I had brought today. And we had cited that case in our brief. But it is kind of a surreal moment for me, because to argue about a half century later about the standard that was created in the Leonardis case. And it was a standard that, you know, the Leonardis case was unique, its circumstances were unprecedented, and it resulted in a standard that was equally unique and unprecedented. Leonardis court was really entering uncharted waters. I think it was the first time that the court addressed an issue of whether it had the power to review a prosecutor's decision not to drop charges, which in essence was what the PTI decision was all about. And while it found that the quasi-judicial aspects of the PTI decision allowed it to order the direct that the prosecutors provide statement of reasons and ultimately have judicial review of those reasons, there were other factors that militated in terms of how high that standard should be. And as this court described it later on in State versus Nwobu, that the role of the prosecutor in the PTI determination was so critical, and specifically because it was the fundamental role of the prosecutor to enforce the laws. And also that a primary purpose of PTI was in fact to augment, not diminish, the options that were available to the prosecutor. And in that context, the Leonardis court created, as Mr. Welfel described, such a high standard, a standard that would allow the overruling of the prosecutor's decision as to PTI admission only under the most egregious of circumstances. And as we demonstrated in our brief, that standard was unprecedented. We were not able to find a single court opinion, not of this state, not of any state, where the precise formulation of Patton and gross abuse of discretion had been used prior to Leonardis. I think we found one opinion of the United States Customs Court in 1973 that kind of used gross or Patton abuse, and those are closest. And of course, since that time, this court has not expressly applied the Patton and gross abuse of discretion standard to any prosecutorial determination other than in the context of PTI and diversion. What the court has done, as Mr. Welpole also described, was to really undertake what is perhaps the most solemn duty that this court has, which is determining what the parameters of the various branches of government are in the light of separation of powers. And specifically in the arena of criminal justice, where the court has recognized, as Justice Garibaldi said, I think in the Ligardis matter, that it is not watertight, the separations between the branches. And in specifically in dealing with situations where the legislature has allowed the prosecutor a role in what could be sentencing decisions or in that general arena, the court has basically set up a dichotomy. It began with Leonardis, where things are kind of like charging decisions. There's going to be a much heightened, an elevated and heightened deference to the prosecutor. When things are more like sentencing, there's going to be a lowered deference to the prosecutor. And in Ligardis and in Vasquez and in Flagg and in ATC, each of those cases, the court consistently recognized that because those were akin to sentencing decisions, or were in fact sentencing decisions, that the lowered standard of deference would apply. Interestingly, of the cases that come under that rubric, the one case where there was not unanimity of this court as to the proper standard was the VA decision, because perhaps to some extent the VA decision did not fall quite as neatly into this sentencing versus charging dichotomy. But this case does fall neatly into that dichotomy. There is not a sliver of daylight between the essence of the Graves Act waiver exemption, the Graves Act waiver decision, and the decisions that the legislature allowed the prosecutor to take part on in the other statutes that Mr. Welpole discussed. And in fact, there may be even more of a reason here, because the legislature in NJSA 2C 43 there, 6.2, specified that the basic metric for evaluating whether there should be a waiver was interest of justice. Now, the Attorney General in their brief said, well, it's the job of the county prosecutor to pursue justice. But pursuing justice isn't the same thing as making a determination as to what's in the interest of justice. And interesting, in Judge Chevelle, and I'm sure I'm pronouncing the Justice Hoffman, you pronounce it much better than I did. I pronounce it Senges, and I'm sure I'm completely wrong. In his separate opinion in that case, and the Attorney General cites to Judge Chevelle's opinion several times in their brief, Judge Chevelle pointedly said that county prosecutors are not the right person to make a decision as to interests of justice. He wrote something to the effect that county prosecutors are not impartial adjudicators. They are charged with enforcing the criminal justice code. Therefore, but they are adversaries, he said. And therefore, he continued, they are not attuned to making sentencing decisions according to interests of justice. But courts are. And I respectfully submit that it would be run against the grain of the solid precedent that this court has laid down in cases like Ligardis and Vasquez and Flagg, and counter to the separation of powers, for the court to allow a prosecutor to, in essence, overrule a court's finding of what's in the interest of justice, unless it is the most exigent of situation. And if the court has any questions, I'm happy to entertain them.
Thank you, Mr. Rosen.
Thank you.
Ms. Hanson.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, Associate Justices. My name is Remy Spencer, and I'm privileged to appear before this court on behalf of the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey. This case presents a fundamental question about the proper standard of judicial review when a prosecutor refuses to waive the mandatory minimum parole ineligibility term under the Graves Act. For too long, New Jersey courts have uncritically imported the heightened patent and gross abuse of discretion standard from the very different context of pretrial intervention, a purely prosecutorial function, into the realm of sentencing, which is and must remain inherently a judicial function. The ACDL of New Jersey submits that the ordinary abuse of discretion standard must apply when courts review prosecutorial refusals to waive Graves Act mandatory minimum sentences. The standard properly respects the critical distinction between charging decisions, where prosecutors are entitled to broad discretion and deference, and sentencing decisions, which ultimately lie within the core authority of the court. We urge this court to realign the standard of review to one that recognizes this constitutional boundary, ensures meaningful judicial oversight of sentencing, and avoids unjust outcomes that mandatory minimums can produce if left to unchecked prosecutorial discretion. I'll focus on three main points. No precedent squarely decides the issue before the court today. Second, the PTI patent and gross standard is misapplied in Graves cases. And third, this court has held that the ordinary abuse of discretion standard applies in sentencing related contexts. First, no precedent, and I will be brief because I understand this is a very late calendar. No precedent.
You're also welcome to adopt arguments we've heard on the history
as
well.
Thank you. The lower courts have relied on State versus Benjamin, which in turn have cited State versus Alvarez and State versus Rodriguez. Benjamin and Rodriguez did not conduct independent analysis. They relied reflexively on Alvarez, which borrowed from the PTI context in Leonardis. Alvarez merely upheld the constitutionality of a prosecutor's authority to a prosecutor's authority under the statute, but it did not establish a universal standard for the denial of Graves waivers. Second, the PTI patent and gross standard is misapplied in Graves cases. It originates from Leonardis, as the court has heard already this afternoon, and it is squarely for prosecutorial determinations about whether or not a defendant should be prosecuted. The ultimate result of PTI in a criminal case is no prosecution. The case is diverted from the justice system. The prosecution is stayed, and if all goes as planned, the case is dismissed. That is quintessentially a prosecutorial function. The Graves Act waiver decision, by contrast, is post-conviction and squarely within the sentencing function of the judiciary. Judicial review over such sentencing-related recommendations must reflect the judiciary's constitutional role in determining punishment. And third, multiple times this court has addressed in the sentencing context the role of the judicial review. Extended terms under the Drug Reform Act of Ligaris, waiver of employment forfeiture under Flagg, the juvenile waivers to adult court in State versus VA, the Jessica Lunsford Act waiver in ATC and the school zone drug offenses in Vasquez all reveal the same principle that has been enunciated from this court. When prosecutorial discretion influences sentencing, this court applies the ordinary abuse of discretion standard. Only in diversion cases or PTI contexts does the Patton and Gross standard apply. I may be one of the only people in this courtroom today that argues PTI appeals at the trial level, and I can assure you that standard leaves very little room for a judge to make a determination. It is the appropriate standard when we are talking about prosecution, not when we talk about sentencing. As my learned counsel have already stated, in State versus VA, the issue of whether to waive the juvenile to the adult criminal court, my assessment of that case is that it's sort of a hybrid. It's sort of a both a prosecutorial determination as well as sentencing, whether to prosecute in the family part as a juvenile or to raise it up to the criminal is clearly a prosecutorial decision. On the other hand, the consequences of the criminal adult sentencing judge are severely more lengthy, harsh than what would be imposed as a juvenile. And even in that case, the hybrid, as I describe it, this court has found that more judicial oversight is required under the ordinary abuse of discretion standard. So in this case, the trial court acknowledged that the 42-month Graves Act sentence was excessive for Mr. Taylor, but was constrained by the very high standard of Patton and Gross abuse. This court should now clarify that the sentencing discretion at issue, particularly when it imposes the harsh penalties of the mandatory minimums enunciated in the Graves Act, should be under the traditional abuse of discretion standard. We respectfully urge this court to reverse the decision below and remand for proper sentencing. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Spencer. Mr. Bingham.
Good afternoon. Please, the court. First, I would just like to ask the justice to think where they were in 1991. I was in middle school. The first George Bush was president. That's how long the courts have been faithfully applying the standard of review in the state. Alvarez adopted the Patton and Gross abuse of discretion standard. It was confirmed by Benjamin in 2015. The state would take a little bit of issue. It was not dicta in Benjamin. It was briefed by the state. It was gone through by the court in the decision in Benjamin. When it was discussing the safeguards, Benjamin also cited De Ligaris, also cited Vasquez. The court was aware of those cases and decided to stick with the Alvarez standard. And there's a reason for that. The court in Damaris, right when the Graves Act came out, made clear the legislative intent that there's supposed to be certainty with Graves Act sentences, and that the legislative intent was a deterrent, not a rehabilitative statute. The intent of the legislature was to treat gun cases more harshly. The Alvarez coming out right on the heels of the waiver recognized that. Damaris recognized that was the intent of the legislature here. The judicial checks are stronger in the Graves Act cases, and the waivers are intended to be in only extraordinary cases as recognized by the courts, especially in Alvarez. This is not such an extraordinary case. And as Justice Patterson asked about the law school standard and the test, there's four elements for Patton and Gross abuse of discretion. The three are considered all the relevant factors, did not consider irrelevant or inappropriate factors. The decision weighing those factors were not a clear abuse. And then the fourth factor, those are all ors. And then the fourth factor is the and that is, does not clearly subvert the intent of the statute. And that is from Nuovo, which was trying to define Patton and Gross abuse of discretion. Granted, it was in a PTI context, but the cases here have adopted the PTI form. And I would note that in the defendant's brief, he cites to Nuovo about the heavy burden that is on the Patton and Gross abuse of discretion standard. However, Heavy burden is also the language that is used in Ligeris. The difference between the two is very, very small. There's not much daylight between these two standards. Applying the patent aggressive user standard to this case, while the court and the prosecutor found different factors, if looking at where the divergence is, and I'll go through them very quickly because I do realize it is late in the day, the prosecutor found aggravating factor 6 and did not find mitigating factor 7 about the extent of the prior record. While the record was minuscule here, there was a prior record. It was appropriate for the prosecutor to have found that there was a prior record and that they're not find mitigating factor 7. As to mitigating factor 2, which is found by the court, that the conduct did not contemplate harm, we had to look at the facts of this case. In this case, we had a defendant who was armed with a prohibited weapon, a semi-automatic handgun, also with prohibited firearm bullets in that they were hollow point. Not only were they in the magazine, one of the bullets was in the chamber of the gun. Here, the defendant fled. The police officer had to pursue, and the police officer was in fact injured in the pursuit. Finally, he discarded the gun where it could have been recovered by anyone in the public area. Mitigating factor 2 was not appropriate in this case. Mitigating factor 9, the character of the defendant, we note that there's a subsequent resisting arrest charge that resulted in a conviction where he pled guilty that was sentenced at the same time as this, which would go to his character. And there's also the subsequent event in Delaware where he was armed with a weapon. In fact, finally, mitigating factor 10 was also not appropriate. The defendant didn't even ask for probation. So that factor considered by the court was also not appropriate. And it was appropriate for the assistant prosecutor to not consider it. In response to a comment by the amicus, and I mean, God bless him. If I was here 50 years from my first argument, which is happens to be today, I don't know what I would be doing, but thank you. The prosecutors do the best they can, and they are trying to find the interest of justice just like anyone else. And the assistant prosecutors are trying to weigh the factors, and they're trying to reach the just conclusion. They're not out for convictions. They're trying to do the best they can. And I just wanted to make that statement in response to that.
You talked about relying upon Alvarez since 91, when I think you said you were in high school. What did Alvarez rely upon? Middle school. Some sort of younger school.
It was a long, long time ago, yes.
What did Alvarez rely upon?
Well, Alvarez was citing to Leonardis. It was citing to the dissent in Singus. And it found the arbitrary, capricious, and unconstitutional violation, but also references Patton and Gross there, which is what, if you look at Watson, cites back to that section where it cites the Patton and Gross abuse. They both were authored by Judge Stern, and Judge Stern in Watson had the opportunity that both Ligeris and Vasquez had come out, and he was aware of it. He cites them in his decision, and the court in Watson stuck with the Alvarez standard. And I think it's because guns are different. And that I think that was recognized by the court.
But was that really the standard in Alvarez? I mean, your adversary argues that the standard in Alvarez was really arbitrarily or unconstitutionally discriminated against the defendant in determining whether the interest of justice were warranted there. And as you just noted, really the only reference to Patton and Gross is the description of Judge Chappelle's dissent from Singes, but the mention of unconstitutional discrimination occurs a couple of times in the Alvarez holding. Isn't that correct?
Right, and that is correct. But I think that the court was calling that the arbitrary, capricious, unconstitutional standard the Patton and Gross. And I think that's, you can see that because Judge Stern also authored Watson and is citing back to it. Right.
Even in Alvarez, in discussing what would happen practically with regard to a defendant appealing a prosecutor's decision, the Alvarez decision says he must make a showing of arbitrariness constituting an unconstitutional discrimination or denial of equal protection. So it just doesn't seem to be the same as Patton and Gross. Abuse of discretion.
The language is different.
And it keeps changing throughout the rest of the opinion in talking about how, in discussing how this happens practically. So it's difficult to see that Alvarez is the case that, you know, started the Patton and Gross abuse of discretion
It's hard to see that, but it is the case that started us along this path. I agree with that. And but even look at in Benjamin, it's referred to as an Alvarez waiver. Everybody is pointing back to Alvarez, and it has been adopted as a patent and gross abuse of discretion standard, which was defined in Nuovo and Bender, and so that's what we're working on.
But in Watson, Judge Stern talks about the fact that he calls it. When defendant may seek an application by arguing the assignment to the assignment judge that the prosecutor's refusal is a patent and gross abuse of discretion. More specifically, the defendant must show that in refusing to move or consent to make such an application of the trial court, the decision was arbitrary and amounted to unconstitutional discrimination or denial of equal protection. And isn't there this strange amalgamation of the two that is very confusing to the practitioners? It eventually evolved into one, which was the title sequence of it, the patent and gross abuse of discretion.
And I think you have those two dichotomies of the language in Alvarez and Watson. And then after that, it's just been adopted as the patent and gross.
This court first addresses it in Benjamin and in a single paragraph of a much lengthier decision that deals with discovery. It's entirely reasonable for you and for this side of the aisle to have followed the patent and gross abuse of discretion standard based on the court's reference to Watson in a parenthetical. But it's harder to say, and I ask you to comment on this, that the court gave a thorough analysis to that particular issue in a decision based on discovery issues.
I think in Benjamin, the court was looking at the whole picture, and that it was going through the safeguards of the waiver and with the discovery issue, but that section where they reference the patent and gross, it's going through kind of the analysis and what's the protections that are there for the defendant. And I think if court talked about Ligeris and talked about Vasquez, and you would have to assume that it was a conscious decision because the court was aware, it was briefed in the state's brief. So it wasn't like it was out of the blue that came up at oral argument. It was there. And so you have to assume that the court knew what it was doing when it chose to use the Alvarez language.
Let's analyze it in a little bit more depth now. And that's why we welcome all of you here today to help us. You've heard the dichotomy that has been presented to the court. Charging decisions are entitled to greater deference. Decisions that are more akin to sentencing, less so. Is a Graves Act waiver more like a charging or a sentencing decision?
It's both. And it's the charges are there and the charges are made by the police and you have the charges and then the indictment. But when you're doing that, it is a prosecutorial function because you can charge a degree lower, you can a different charge, you have those options. And I think that it kind of fits into both.
Because, couldn't the same be said as to all the mandatory minimum cases? Jessica Lund's a good example. Yeah. If you can charge the first degree, but if you do, you're going to have the 25-year waiver under Jessica Lunsford unless mandatory minimum, unless there's a waiver. So don't all of these, VA is different.
VA is different, right.
It's the case. But the ones that deal with...
They're all sentencing issues. I agree with that. But I think you have to look at the initial cases that came out when the Graves Act came out and that cite the legislative intent, that cite the dangers of guns and the proliferation of guns. And that there was, and you have to look at Chief Justice Wilentz's directive that came out at the same time. I think that the guns are different. And just because all of these are sentencing doesn't mean they have to be treated the same.
Your answer to the question was it's a bit of both, not an unfair answer. Is it more like one than the other?
I think it's probably more like sentencing. But as I said, I don't think that just because they're all sentencing that they have to be treated the same.
If you were looking at the cases, you'd have to acknowledge that Alvarez relies on Changis. And then the year after Alvarez, Vasquez sort of takes away the foundation of why Changis went to a patent and gross standard, right? Changis was a CDS case, and yes. Changis went to patent and gross. And actually Changis, if you trace it down, goes all the way down to Leonardis, goes all the way down to PTI. So you have Chang'e's resting on two foundations, one a PTI foundation, which substantively we're distinguishing, and two, a precedential foundation of CDS, which then the year after Alvarez, Vasquez abrogates and says, no, the CDS mandatory cases shouldn't be patent engrossed. They should be regular abuse of discretion. Doesn't, in a sense, doesn't the foundation that supported Alvarez, that upon which so much of what you are relying sort of crumble when those two things happen?
If it wasn't for Watson, possibly, Your Honor, but I think that with Watson was aware of both Ligaris and Vasquez, and nevertheless stuck with Alvarez. And I think this court in Benjamin was aware of it too, and still cited back to Alvarez, even though Vasquez had intervened at that point.
Could you remind at least me, because I was on the Benjamin decision, how this came up in Benjamin, why the state raised it and argued it?
I don't know why the state raised it in the brief, but there's a section about the standard.
I was trying to remember the connection.
It was brought up at oral argument by a few justices. I believe Your Honor brought it up. I believe Justice Lehecki brought it up, I believe, as well. But the standard of review, and even if you look at the dissent in Benjamin, also is stating patent and gross abuse of discretion. So it was discussed at oral argument, but it was in the state's brief, yes. And then the court, it was a brief analysis, but the court does go through the safeguards and does cite Vasquez and Ligaris and nevertheless stuck with Alvarez.
Other questions? Anything else you'd like to add, counsel?
I just want to thank the court for your time and consideration, and I would ask that the appellate division be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Schwartz.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'd like to start with the last question that was asked about where we get this in Benjamin. And the issue in Benjamin, yes, was a discovery issue. But if we look at the Benjamin opinion, the reason the court starts with is in order to determine whether that discovery, the defendant was entitled to that discovery, it was looking at whether or not there were sufficient procedural safeguards for a defendant to be able to challenge a prosecutor's decision about a Graves Act waiver. So that's where this court in Benjamin started from in analyzing whether they were entitled to that discovery and went through the procedural safeguards that existed, being the Attorney General's directive with a statement of reasons, providing a written statement of reasons, and then also the standard of review. And yes, we start with Alvarez, which relied on the dissent in Senghis, and that's changed. We have to look at the whole history because we're not here on a clean slate. We have the Alvarez decision, and then we have Watson interpreting Alvarez to mean patent and gross. And then we come to the court in Benjamin, which cites both Alvarez and Watson explaining that it was this patent and gross standard of review. And Judge Stern in the 90s, after Ligaris and Vasquez came out, decided Watson and Master Peter and invited review, saying that when I decided Alvarez, I didn't have the benefit of Ligaris and Vasquez. And there was no invite by the defense bar at that time to say that the patent and gross standard was not working or should be revisited for Graves Act waiver at that time, despite the invitation from Judge Stern in two decisions. And so when we're looking at
Do you remember whether, or not, we wouldn't remember, you're too young, but in your research, whether or not there was a cert petition in that case?
In Master Pietro Watson?
Yes.
I don't know for those cases, but I do know in Rodriguez and the unpublished decision in Theslamine, which are more recent cases than the Judge Stern's decisions, but there were motions for leave to appeals in those cases that did highlight the standard of review issue, and this court did not grant motion for leave to appeal in those cases. And I think Benjamin clearly adopts the sufficiency of the standard review for patent and gross because we're looking at procedural safeguards that are available to the defendant in order to challenge the prosecutor's waiver decision. The standard review is part of that sufficiency of those procedural safeguards. So I think this court clearly adopted the patent and gross standard in Benjamin, and that's why it was in the decision. And yes, it was brought up at oral argument about whether or not it was part of the decision. And the answer by the Attorney General was yes, because in order to determine if there's sufficient procedural safeguards, you have to determine the standard of review. And then the opinion reflects that in its decision. And I think that's why, because we're not here on a clean slate, we all, what makes Graves Act waiver unique is the procedure that has developed from this long 30-year history of, it's not, yes, it's a sentencing decision, it's more akin to those cases, but it has unique procedures that don't exist in those other contexts. As this court in Benjamin highlighted, when we have Graves Act waiver, it doesn't go to the trial court, the sentencing court judge, it goes to the assignment judge, and or its designee, and they are the judge that is handling all the waivers for that county. And that's why in Benjamin, this court said that they're in the best position to make this finding of the Alvarez standard, which has been interpreted as patent and gross abuse, to whether or not there is discrimination in the prosecutor's decision. And I don't think that we're here on a separation of powers question, because I think Alvarez states that the availability of that judicial review is what answers the separation of powers question. And then again, in Benjamin, if there was a separation of powers issue about Graves Act waiver, this court would have addressed that then and said that it wasn't sufficient without.
Benjamin invoked this concept as one of a few procedural safeguards that are available to the defendant in the context of the discovery. In reviewing the oral argument in Benjamin, which I have not, and I don't recall it specifically, was the state saying to this court, there's perhaps a dispute as to what the standard of review is. You need to determine the standard of review in order to define the procedural safeguard that's available for the defendant, notwithstanding the denial of discovery in Benjamin. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Was it presented as something the court needed to decide?
It wasn't directed as like a explicit answer that this court needed to answer. But if we look at both the oral argument, the state's brief, and the opinion, it was well accepted that this language of Alvarez was the standard for Graves Act waivers, because if we look at
the question, disputed, meaning the defendant in that case didn't argue it should not be a patent and gross abuse of discretion standard. Instead, it should be some other standard.
Correct, Your Honor.
The court specifically said in that oral argument that the standard of review was not at issue.
I disagree with that interpretation. There was questioning between the state's attorney and the court at that time, and the question was posed as, was this at issue? And the answer from the state was that, yes, it was an issue. In order to determine the procedural safeguards that existed, the standard of review was definitely a consideration the court had to take into account when deciding its decision. And then when we look at that opinion, that's where we have this court adopting the Alvarez standard, but also Watson's interpretation of that language as being the patent and gross abuse of discretion standard.
And the court seemed to say it was necessary to its holding because the words are before addressing the issue raised in this appeal, which would make it seem like it's dicta, comma, we must first determine whether sufficient procedural safeguards are in place to protect a defendant's right to challenge the denial of a Graves Act waiver. And then that's where it discusses patent and gross abuse of discretion. So then it makes it seem like it's part of the holding that the only reason they're deciding that there is not this right to, or one of the reasons they're deciding there's not this right to get this discovery is because there already are these sufficient procedural safeguards, one of which is the patent and gross abuse of discretion.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that especially when we look at the why Alvarez was so accepted by this court in Benjamin, if we look at the dissent in Benjamin, the issue was how does the defendant meet the equal protection unconstitutional discrimination burden without this discovery that they were saying that they were entitled to. And although the court ultimately decided that they were not entitled to that discovery, part of the reason was because of these sufficient procedural safeguards, and that they're very unique to Graves Act waivers, the procedure about the assignment judge being the only judge that handles these waivers for the county. And then also, although the court in Benjamin denied the discovery request, that procedure has developed into common practice in the trial courts of prosecutors having to answer to other comparisons of cases that waiver was granted in. It happened in this case, there was 15 called on by the court for the prosecutor to answer. In the published decision in Andrews, there was 3, and the prosecutor's failure to answer that call of why there was disparate decisions was per se abuse of discretion, patent abuse of discretion, and there was a reversal in that case because the prosecutor couldn't answer for why there was different decisions made in similar cases. In the unpublished decisions that are referenced in the Attorney General's brief, Deslamine had 123 comparators, Randolph had 10, and Taylor had 15 in this case. So that procedure that was envisioned in Benjamin, and as the appellate division said in its published decision in Rodriguez, has developed into this robust judicial review that serves as a backstop to the prosecutor's discretion of the Graves Act waiver question. And that unique procedure takes it out of the ordinary context of, is this just sentencing or is this more like charging? Because we're looking at whether or not the prosecutor is stepping into a role that the judge would otherwise have. And that's not happening here, given this these unique procedures that exist in the context of the Graves Act waiver. And because Benjamin does adopt this, it is precedential and has been established by multiple appellate division decisions. There's the two
Stepping back from what you've just said,
yeah.
Would you agree that Graves Act waiver decisions are more like charging, more like sentencing than charging decisions?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think, but that's important in the context of why we can't start if it was just a brand new Graves Act waiver was just decided and we were before this court on the first instance of what type of standard review. It may be that the ordinary abuse of discretion would be the standard that this court adopts, but that's not what happened here. We have 34 years of established practice and principle, and that is something that has to come before the court in its analysis of the sufficiency of the procedures here and what standard review is working. And because of the Benjamin decision, defendant has to meet his burden that there's special justification to depart from the established practice. And that burden is not met here because of the unique procedures that exist in the Graves Act waiver context. It can't just be its sentencing, it should have consistency with all other sentencing without considering these unique facts that have developed for the last 34 years and the actual increased robust review that defendants receive in a Graves Act waiver context.
Which, when you think it through in terms of how Benjamin, the role that this issue had in Benjamin, the court, and I was part of that, was saying there are these procedural safeguards. One of them is this patent and gross abuse of discretion standard. In other words, if it's the rare case, you could get some appellate review on this. But of course, if there had been a robust discussion of the alternatives there, the argument an ordinary abuse of discretion standard of review were applied, that would even be a higher procedural safeguard. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
So it's the argument from the perspective of the state might have been stronger if there had been the abuse of discretion standard, and that may be a reason why there wasn't really a dispute in that case as to what it was.
Yes, Your Honor, but also this court in the Benjamin opinion says that it's relying on Lagares and Vasquez. So it's obviously the court was aware of the other sentencing waiver decisions that do adopt the ordinary abuse of discretion standard, but still found that the patent and gross abuse of discretion standard provided sufficient procedural safeguards for the judicial review of the prosecutor's decision.
Besides your stare decisis argument, is there any reason why the state stands in a better position than the court in making this determination that would authorize the highest level of discretion available when reviewing this?
So I think this, again, the uniqueness of the Graves Act waiver. The Graves Act is a deterrence-based statute. When it was first came out, that we have the issue from Chief Justice Welland saying that like it's the ordinary case, there has to be something else before you can engage in these plea negotiations in order to take away the effect of the deterrence factor of these mandatory minimums. And then again, if you look at the Desmartes case, there was again other judicial procedural stop that they couldn't do suspended sentences. So in the uniqueness of the Graves Act waiver, there have been other decisions by this court about limits on the judicial impact on removing the mandatory minimum to not achieve the deterrence goal of the Graves Act itself.
And the statute doesn't actually provide for any judicial review of the prosecutor's decision, correct? It's just the prosecutor says yes or no, and there's no judicial review in the statute at all.
There is none, but again, Alvarez already decided that it doesn't violate the separation of powers as long as that judicial review is available, and it is clearly available and even has been become more robust throughout the procedures that have been adopted, because as this court in Benjamin indicated, there was nothing stopping assignment judges from collecting the statement of reasons from other cases, and even though the defendant wouldn't be entitled to them, prosecutors are being called upon to answer for those comparative cases.
One thing is curious is that this whole, in Alvarez, it started out as a constitutional determination of more of a traditional judicial application of equal protection to a statutory framework that was at the time relatively new. And that kind of dropped out along the way. It doesn't appear in Benjamin. It is a little bit in Watson, but it just sort of evaporated in the course of these cases.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
It could be because this court was aware of Ligaris and Vasquez and having such a high standard of a constitutional realm for a prosecutor's decision might have been too high of a standard for a standard review for a defendant to meet. But I still think that adopting the language of Watson, that especially from Judge Stern, who wrote both decisions, and then this court not only just citing to Alvarez, but adopting the Watson parenthetical that said that that is the patent and gross abuse standard. And I think that that makes sense in the context of the four elements that are in a patent and gross abuse standard, being that that fourth one is it subverts the goals of the statute or is so far wide of the mark that it requires judicial interference. And I think that when we look at the deterrence goals of the Graves Act and we're adding that extra element in and of itself, it makes sense in the context of what this court has already spoken to in terms of the Graves Act waiver. And it's not the case where, yes, the Graves Act expanded in 2008, but even in 2017 in Benjamin, when referencing this 6.2 waiver, it says it's still the limited exception. It's not the ordinary exception. And the unpublished decisions that are referenced in the Attorney General's brief, pages 16 and 17, mount the state's, it was a state's appeal coming from a waiver saying that prosecutor did engage in patent and gross abuse discretion, and the appellate division affirmed, and defendant was granted that waiver. And we know from Andrews, which is a published decision, that again, the prosecutor is found to engage in a patent and gross abuse of discretion standard. So defendant has not pointed to any unworkable standard that is needed to go over this established practice that has been the state's for 34 years, especially like when we look at state.
Sorry, you talked before about the unique role that a judge plays in the comparative analysis construct that has developed in this area, right? And isn't it sort of ironic then that this construct would have developed that gives the judge a significant insight and review from a sentencing perspective of these decisions on the comparative analysis that's going on. But at the same time that the judge has been given this more unique role in performing this analysis, that there should be a less deferential standard. That doesn't really seem to jive. You would think, to the degree to which a construct has been developed that vests additional sentencing discretion responsibility with the judge, that would come with the judge's ability to exercise an abuse of discretion standard and not a patent and gross abuse of discretion standard. I'm not sure how that circle is squared.
I actually disagree with, I think that makes sense because of the extra involvement by the judiciary in these Graves Act waivers. We can review the prosecutor's decision under a higher standard because the judiciary is involved at a higher level. So we don't have to worry about the prosecutor acting in just an ordinary abuse discretion manner. It's the judiciary is acting in in concert with the prosecutor and is a check at every level. So when we're looking at that in the overall arch, it makes sense that we'd have give the prosecutor more discretion when the availability of a check by the judiciary is much more prevalent in that scenario, because we're not having disparate, we're not having like trial courts or sentencing courts making unique sentencing decisions. We have one judge that is available and able to review how the prosecutors in that county is acting and making sure that the AG's directive is achieving its goal of uniformity in Graves Act waivers.
Counsel, I don't want to cut you short if there's more you want to say on the merits of this, but I'd like you also to address your alternative argument. If the court adopts a different standard, abusive discretion standard, should it be prospective only, as you've argued in your brief, or prospective pipeline retroactivity?
It should be prospective only. It is a new area, a new rule of law, especially given this history of the 34 years. It doesn't have anything to do with the fact-finding function or the evidence presented to the jury. However, this court is more inclined to adopt pipeline retroactivity. The number of defendants that this would affect would be a small amount, because it would be those defendants that already the trial court said that there was abuse discretion, but not a patent abuse discretion. And that might not be on the record, but the attorney general envisions that the defendant would be able to go back to that initial fact finder and ask them to make that finding on the record in order to move forward with pipeline retroactivity.
Do you have any ballpark figure as to what that means in terms of the number?
The attorney general does receive the quarterly reports from the counties, but they don't include the waiver denials, just the grants. But if this court is inclined for me to get those numbers, I'd make them available to the court.
No need to do so unless you hear from the clerk of the court. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Just that if this court is inclined to adopt the ordinary abuse of discretion standard, that it make explicit that it is a clear and convincing standard. Court in Lagares did say that it's a highly generous deferential standard, and it's not just the situation that the judge still cannot substitute its judgment for the prosecutor's. If there's no further questions, the attorney general just asks for this court to make explicit the patent and gross abuse discretion standard.
Thank you. Mr. Welfel?
Three very brief remarks.
And a question as well. News for you first.
Just with respect to the only principle that I heard in an attempt to articulate a distinction between why Graves Act should be different is reference to Chief Justice Wilentz's directive. And I'll just note that in terms of the Graves Act waiver should be extraordinary. That predates the 2008 amendment, which for the first time in 2008, the legislature pulled 39.5B, simple possession without a permit, into the ambit of the Graves Act mandatory minimum. And it was that change, which is what prompted the Attorney General to issue the guidelines and in fact define the interest of justice standard as the initial plea offer for these simple possession cases should be a waiver unless the aggravating factors outweigh the mitigating. Watson and Alvarez also both predated the 2008 amendment, which may be why they had a higher standard.
And that AG guideline applied only to these possession cases, these new cases, or to all Graves Act offenses?
The 2008 guideline applies to all of the Graves Act waiver cases. But when you read the heart of it, it does seem like it's most often going to be the simple possession that are going to be getting this standardized plea offer. So that's my point one. Point two, to the extent that this court views Benjamin as stare decisis precedent, my colleagues have indicated we haven't proven that this is unworkable in practice. Well, that's only one of the three bases to depart from stare decisis. The one we are advocating is unsound in principle, and we've set forth why on our dichotomy of PTI, prosecutorial function, versus sentencing the judicial function, why it's unsound in principle. And just briefly to touch upon Benjamin itself, yeah, I've read all the briefs in Benjamin. I listened to the entire oral argument. The attorney general who represented the state in that case, Deputy Attorney General Carol Henderson, did cite Watson for the patent gross abuse of discretion standard in the brief. At oral argument, and this is around 1 hour and 32 minutes in dialogue with Justice Patterson, does ask the court.
It's a full hour and 32 minutes that Justice Patterson was.
I was just getting started.
It was at the hour and 32 minute mark. It was in rebuttal. It was in her rebuttal. And she was asking the court to decide. And she actually did say at that point, she didn't think it needed to be all the way to the level of PTI. Obviously, I'm not, you know, the Attorney General's not bound by that. But, you know, it is interesting to note. And it was Justice Patterson, you said, well, that issue wasn't raised. That issue hasn't been briefed in terms of debated what standard should apply. Is your opponent on notice? And that's why we don't view Benjamin as squarely addressing.
And
the
what
issue.
Was the AG's response to that question?
I believe the Attorney General today said that correctly that the Deputy Attorney General Carol Henderson asked the court to decide it. But I think the concern regarding it not being at issue and not being squarely argued in either case between the two standards is correct. And the reason that Deputy Attorney General Carol Henderson asked the court to decide is, it appeared to me from the argument, she actually had concerns over the discriminatory aspect of the Alvarez standard, focusing litigants' attention and the court's attention too much on the comparator analysis. And I actually think that is a fair point. I think, you know, the Attorney General says Rodriguez defines the comparator analysis and should stand. We don't have any issue with that. But we actually do think the first analysis from the assignment judge in reviewing for abuse of discretion should be the Attorney General guidelines. And I think if this court directs that, that would actually provide a much better basis rather than we're just looking at all these defendants similar. You're looking at the reasons given. And to the extent you use comparators, it's to look at were the facts that are considered aggravating in this circumstance actually considered mitigating in a different circumstance, which that goes to arbitrariness, right? Is the Attorney General looking at the same facts as aggravating across the board or the same facts as mitigating across the board? And then to my final point, just I do think one fact asserted by the state does indicate why ordinary abuse of discretion is essential here because it's a sentencing determination. So the state argues that Mr. Taylor in Delaware was again armed with a weapon. And they wrote that in their brief. What they cite in their Supreme Court brief is their trial court brief. And in fact, when you actually look at the police reports that were appended, what they show is that Mr. Taylor was the victim of a shooting. He was found lying in the street, riddled with bullet holes, and there's a pool of blood next to him. There was a gun close by. That gun was swabbed. It was fingerprinted. He's never been charged. I understand why the state, as the prosecutor, is like, look, this guy's, he has an open gun case. Now he's near another gun. We don't want to offer him a waiver. That makes sense from the prosecutor's perspective. And that's why we want to entrust the ultimate decision to the judge to step back, review the facts, and say, well, what do the facts actually prove? And that's why it should be ordinary abuse of discretion entrusted ultimately to the judge as the ultimate backstop.
But the actual letter, sorry, here, explaining why the Graves Act waiver was unwarranted, didn't say anything about that initially, and just explained how defendant was noncompliant with the officers, ran away when they asked him to stop, placed the officers and individuals on scene at risk of injury during the encounter and caused injury to one of the officers, and that the handgun was loaded with hollow point bullets.
If Your Honor is referring to the 2020 letter, that is correct, because the incident that the state later cited to happened later. I will just note that, again, the 2020 letter doesn't weigh the aggravating mitigating factors and does not cite the Attorney General directive's presumption or identify one.
But it does. Sorry, I thought it does contrast the case to an example discussed in the AG directive. So even if it doesn't use the words AG directive explicitly, it's clearly relying on the AG directive by contrasting it with an example included in that directive where the defendant had, quote, no prior involvement with the criminal justice system. The firearm in question was unloaded and the circumstances make clear that the firearm poses no risk to officer or public safety.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that was a misuse of the directive, because that example is cited in the 2008 directive as a circumstance that would be appropriate for probation. but is not the threshold requirement for the waiver in and of itself.
Understood, but they were obviously, they believed, looking at the directive. You're saying they were looking at the directive wrongly, but I thought you had been arguing they actually ignored the directive altogether. And it seems pretty clear that they didn't ignore the directive altogether because they were explicitly relying on it in a way that you think is incorrect.
And I'm sorry if that's the impression I gave. My argument was that they did not follow the directive correctly. That was my argument.
The Attorney General argued that if the court changes the standard, it underscore clear and convincing. Can you respond to that?
Well, I think that is what this court has said in Vasquez and Lagares throughout these cases. What I take clear and convincing to mean is that's just, another way of saying the assignment judge doesn't substitute their judgment. They're not, to the extent they're reviewing the aggravated and mitigating factors found by the prosecutor in the first instance, they are not then sitting themselves as a sentencing judge and comparing. They're reviewing the reasons given. And it may be appropriate if there are errors made that don't rise to the level of clear and convincing that, suppose the prosecutor erroneously relied on dismissed charges, but it was a small thing in the overall scheme of their analysis. Perhaps it would be appropriate if it doesn't rise to the level of clear and convincing error in judgment that a remand for reconsideration to the prosecutor be appropriate in that circumstance, but to actually override this court's precedent does say it would be clear and convincing.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to counsel for the helpful arguments and for the lovely references that took us down memory lane. I'm going to add one to that, and that is talking about Judge Stern's opinions today reminded me and perhaps others of what a privilege it was to serve with that fine judge and fine person on this court. Court's adjourned for the day.